Our first podcast of 2022 is from ITS America in Charlotte, North Carolina. A better future transformed by intelligent mobility. Lunch with Leon is brought to you by ITTHub.net. And this week is sponsored by One Network, the world-leading platform for planning, monitoring, and communicating in real time. Everything disrupting the road network, including roadworks and right-of-way changes.
And so welcome to 2022 and another year of Lunch with Leon. And we're starting off in a spectacular fashion. We're at ITS America, and I was talking to One Network's Chief Executive, James Harris.
So James, here we are at ITS America. This is exciting, isn't it? Because we've not been able to come here for a long time now.
Very exciting. My first visit to the States since launching our platform in the US. So it's been a strange time during COVID, trying to remotely get ourselves off the ground in the US, and very exciting to be here for the first time.
And I think you've been to one of the, in fact, you were at the inaugural panel session, weren't you?
Yeah, I was delighted to be invited along to speak as part of the Big Data Revolution panel session, chaired by Scott Belcher, who will be well known to American listeners of your podcast, as the former president of ITS America. Really great fun session with other data companies in the sector, debating, I suppose, the changing role of road agencies broadly and the opportunities that data and new sources of data present.
So who else was on the panel?
So we had Wejo, very interesting connected vehicle data aggregator, who recently launched on the NASDAQ at an eye-watering valuation, and a business that has a real vision behind it to bring together the very granular, very interesting data being gathered by connected vehicles. And we also had Flow Labs, who are taking some of that data and other sources of information to provide insights and optimization services for road agencies.
Amazing. Well, that's tremendous. Well, why don't we go and take a look at the rest of the show and see if we can find some other people who might want to come and join us.
Great stuff. Looking forward to it.
Well, I was really delighted to find the president and chief executive of ITS America, and I grabbed a few minutes with Laura Chase. So, Laura, here we are at ITS America. You must be thrilled with this show.
Yes, we're very excited. We're very pleased with the show. We've had a lot of great networking, great attendance, good sessions, an exciting exhibit floor, and we've heard good feedback from attendees so far.
Well, I'm just blown away, and I've spoken to some people going around the show, and the artificial intelligence and the machine learning and all of this stuff, I can't get over it. We are optimizing all of our networks in a way that we never thought possible, isn't it?
Yeah, it's really interesting. And I think we've heard, you know, some of this really came on the scene, you know, quite fast because of the pandemic and the need to have systems in place that could, you know, optimize systems and remotely monitor systems. And so it's really just become commonplace now.
And I'm really blown away by the contribution to safety. I've seen some things here, things we wouldn't have dreamt of even the last time we were all together, the real progress that technology is making towards safety. I think this is just amazing.
Yeah, I mean, that's something I've been saying from day one, which is that we have a real opportunity here to use technology to improve safety. And while there's a lot of different solutions that are needed holistically to improve safety in our transportation system, technology is quite honestly our best tool to actually save lives.
So, Laura, where are we going to be next time?
So we're so excited that in September of 2022, we will be in Los Angeles, California for the World Congress. And we're really looking forward to welcoming the world to LA.
Laura, I'm going to be there. I look forward to seeing you there. Congratulations on a really fabulous ITS America event. I guess you get some sleep after this.
Yes. Thank you so much.
Brilliant. And thank you for coming. Thank you. Bye-bye.
And next on my trip around ITS America in Charlotte, I came across Patrick Sun, who's the Senior Transportation Engineer at Gannett Fleming in Philadelphia. And he and I shared some interesting things about traffic management and traffic control. So, Patrick,
yeah.
how's the show been for you?
It's been great. It's, you know, being able to reconnect with people after a couple of years of being at home and seeing them virtually. So 3D is always good in person, in real life. And it's great. Like 7 years ago when I moved to D.C., I was actually a staffer staff person at ITS America. So this is kind of like home base for me in a lot of ways.
You're a transportation control expert. You must have seen a lot of changes over the years.
Oh, absolutely. I remember even the first time I stepped foot in a transportation operations center or transportation management center, and I was totally enamored from the get-go. But now when I think about the possibilities that we have with edge computing, with artificial intelligence and machine learning, it's amazing at how we can actually enhance what operators might even do on a day-to-day to really affect the lives of people on the roadway. And the rate of change every 5 years, Leon, every 5 years we're going through incredible rates of change within all of our agencies. So it's been exciting, to say the least.
When I first saw my traffic control room in London, it was a dedicated facility. The whole thing had been made. By the time we'd finished, it was a series of desks with computers. And, you know, the place could have been anything because all the equipment, the specialist equipment we needed had been replaced by specialist software. And what was really clever was what had changed was the system were offering solutions to the controllers so the controllers could make some decisions about what to use. And that's just transformed the job. The job moved from being playing an instrument in an orchestra, and the job became conducting the orchestra.
Absolutely. And, you know, if you even think about it from the operator perspective or the manager perspective that's on the floor responding to the numerous incidents and the work zones that we have on the roadway, it is just like you said, we need to be recruiting conductors that can manage multiple incidents, multiple different types of events, and have an understanding of how each bar, each measure plays into all of it. And in this case, that translates to each data, each piece of analytics, each bit of information, and understand that and make sense of it, right? Because as great as technology is, the hardest thing that the technology has is context, knowing the streets of London, knowing the streets of, you know, Washington, D.C., knowing the travel patterns, and just intuitively start to build that in. So, you know, will technology and AI and machine learning sometimes get there? Sure, but we have a long road. In the meantime, we are going to rely on people to bring the context, but the rate of decision-making, the power of decision-making has become so much more valuable because of the different software solutions that are presenting information. So yeah, I agree that orchestra conductor analogy is great.
I mean, the other thing that worked for us in London, so what we were trying to do in London, we weren't trying to make journeys as quick as possible. We were trying to make the journey times as consistent as possible. So if the journey normally took 25 minutes, it always took 25 minutes, not sometimes 20 and sometimes 50. So is that the same thing for you here in the US?
Absolutely. And, you know, granted, we'll call it reliability, call it what you will, but the predictability of being able to know how long a train ride is going to take, how long a drive is going to take, or even a walk for that matter, a bike ride. Knowing that makes our lives a little bit less hectic. And in our lives right now, we're just dealing with information overload, choice overload, let me put it that way. Because how many times do you have to make a decision throughout the day on all sorts of things? Everything is, it's your choice, but when you come to transportation, we need variables to be a little bit less dynamic, right? From a personal user perspective, if I don't know how long it takes me to drop off my kid at school and that changes every day, that's going to ruin my entire week, right? Like, you want to know how long it's going to take for you to get your kid to your school. And we appreciate that so much, especially in our industry.
And what's the next thing? I mean, there's some wonderful software solutions here in Charlotte. We're in the Charlotte Convention Center for ITS America. And I'm looking around this stands here, bristling with new technology. And what's impressive for me is some of it's to do with safety, which is great. Some of it is to do about the consistent journey times. Some of it is about the optimization of data. And what sort of things here have struck you?
You know, for me, Leon, it's been a lot with the granularity of the data, how much deeper and how much wider we're going to be able to get. Case in point, LiDAR used to be a technology that we thought would take decades to get to the size and the processing power. Now we're talking about using LiDAR and camera analytics to look at near misses at an intersection. the detail that we have instead of just inferring what's going on, inferring, oh, there's this movement, it's having this conflict. As an engineer, I can actually see the data of how people are interacting in an intersection that I designed with technology that I'm putting out there. And that gives me real-time feedback to improve continuously. And in the software world, it's like a little bit more of, to get to agile development, you need a really good feedback process. And for the longest time in our industry, we didn't have the data and the sensors to actually get the feedback of how well our designs are coming out there. Now we're starting on that precipice. There's methods and technology and devices to tell us feedback on how great our designs are or how bad they are. We intended to solve a certain problem. We may have introduced two other problems. It's not to say they're bad. It's just we need to learn, and we need to learn quickly, and we need to fix it and change it and move on. And so I'm really excited by the amount of technology that's available to look at really closely intersection level movement, near misses, right? Pedestrian vehicle interactions, be able to log it intelligently. And it's not going to take months to figure out the data. We're talking minutes. We're talking like in an hour, and you'll have really real time and even almost collect data. And that is super exciting, Leon. I mean, that's where we can.
I know. And for me, the things I'm seeing here in several areas, this self-calibrating, self-learning. Actually, one of the great things with transportation in any form is every day we get a chance to do it again. And the great thing about this self-calibrating, self-learning software that I'm seeing here is that it learns. It learns, and so the data that we get each day is progressively better. We feed that data back in. So one of the things I remember seeing when we were planning the Olympic Games in London, we had some planning tools that allowed us to have a fly-through to actually visualize the VIP cars for the Olympic Games making their way through traffic so we could see them actually making progress. What was exciting for me was, won't be long, will it, before our visualization of what we think will happen will actually become the instructions for what is going to happen. So the planning and the execution is going to become the same thing, isn't it?
Absolutely. And when you think about augmented reality and the digital mapping that is going to be one of the driving forces in our industry, the ability for cars, we see it now. Some cars have these heads-up display that'll give you a lot of warnings, or, you know, now when you can start to see the lane markings and the car starts to learn better of how to navigate the roadways, this is going to just start to merge and converge. And I think that's really exciting from a safety perspective, from a mobility perspective, and, you know, from a user perspective. I think about my wife a lot. Well, you should in general. There's different aspects of, like, her walking around the streets with a stroller. You know, I think now we're at a point where we can actually change our approach to make sure that that's our primary user. And so one of the things that I've written about is this idea that for the longest time in transport, our user had been your typical office worker commuter. And that's been driving, you know, a lot of our analysis, a lot of our planning, a lot of our design. And we've learned a lot from it. And we almost want to thank that user. Now we have the opportunity to expand the number of users we get to design around for, to plan around for. And I kind of joke, but on every construction site, I would love to see construction inspectors go around with a stroller and see how safe they feel. And if they feel safe, that construction zone is ready to go, right? You know,
that's entirely right.
I thought about it, and it's mostly because my wife started nagging at me. She, you know, after we had our first kid, she's like, Patrick, do something about this. I'm like, well, one, it's not up to me, but it did start to get me thinking, why is it so hard for a parent with a stroller to get around? And the streets are a little narrow, there's more people walking, which is great. More people walking, but then what about the people with wheelchairs or, you know, parents with strollers? And it just makes you realize, oh, we can actually change our perspective. And we have the tools to really enhance the experience on our transport system.
And, you know, the thing it would allow us to do, we're just starting in the UK to think about a road user hierarchy, that actually pedestrians are more important than cyclists, who are more important than public transportation, who are more important than deliveries, who are more important than car drivers, say. So the great thing about these tools and the ones we're seeing here today is those tools help us with that hierarchy, because it helps us make advantage for pedestrians and cyclists. It helps us disadvantage, where appropriate, private car users. And where there is lots of demand, it rations the space effectively. Where there isn't so much demand, it just lets it go. And I think these tools will just bring us for the first time to being able to say who is more important than who on the highway. Because until recently, it's been a free-for-all where the bigger you are, the more likely you are to barge your way through.
How great is it that we can actually... And it's not a zero-sum game, right? It's not like pedestrians win, cars lose, or anything like that. You know, in the U.S., one thing that I've actually championed is this concept, and I'm not the only person, but looking at the system, so transportation, system management, and operations, we have to understand operations. That's where your live data is going to live and breathe and really make, you know, cognitive choices on it. But if we approach everything with a zero-sum game, we're going to lose, no matter which way you approach it, no matter who you prioritize. But if you look at it as a system, how are you going to manage your system more efficiently? That's when I think we're going to see the gains, because we're not going to have to worry about whether to make please everyone. So then you have a really large street that tries to accommodate every single mode, or you have to make some people mad to make some people happy. Right? It isn't that. I think it's if you show people a little bit of the larger picture and you show them, here's how we're approaching the system, where now they have options of even choosing, again, with choices, but like choosing multiple ways that they can travel instead of just one. And that's really exciting, because I think every transportation planner, engineer, started their career envisioning that state, right? And if I can say anything, like, you know, especially now at the tail end of 2021, we're getting really close to being able to have a lot of tools available to start accelerating that vision that we all kind of got interested in. And I mean, you know this probably more than I do, Leon, of when you first started your career, you probably, you know, had a vision too.
Sure. Well, my vision's getting a little blurry now, of course, with the passage of time. But Patrick, I mean, the thing that just occurs to me in talking to you and seeing everything here at ITS America, the future's really exciting. We're really going to make a big difference. And people like you and others that have been here at ITS America, getting hold of the problem that is mobility and using computers, using data, using really sophisticated machine learning, artificial intelligence with clever people, is going to make mobility and transportation better for the future. And I'm really excited about this.
Absolutely. Same here.
Patrick, thank you so much for joining me today. And I'm so excited for the future. Thanks for coming on the show. And of course, look forward to seeing you somewhere else in the world very soon.
Same here. Thank you so much, Leon. I appreciate you bringing me on.
And then I was really pleased to run into Laurie Matkowski. She's the Director of Connected and Automated Vehicle Services at Gannett Fleming. And we exchanged some interesting thoughts about whether autonomous vehicles are really here. So, Laurie, we're here at ITS America. Mm-hmm. We're in Charlotte, where the weather, funnily enough, is a bit like it is in UK. So it's about 5 degrees and dull, mm-hmm. A little bit of sun. Sun goes down about 4:30. So it's like, for me, it's like being at home. But I was going to ask you, so in the UK, the jury is out on autonomous vehicles.
Okay.
So some really important people say it's never going to happen. What's your view?
It's already here, though. So I always, when people say, here's what I pose the question to them. Have you ever been into an autonomous vehicle? Or an automated vehicle is like what I prefer to say, automated vehicle. And they say, never. I would never be in that. I said, well, do you have cruise control in your car? And they say, yes. So well, guess what? That's an automated vehicle. And I said, oh, well, I didn't know that. And so then everybody's hands go up because they've all experienced this technology. And so autonomous is a form of automated, in my view, and in a lot of people's view. It's that fully no driver, no hands. And if you know the levels of automation, that's the highest level of having no driver, no steering wheel. So that's the scariest part that the public sees, and they're most worried about that. But they don't understand, for the most part, that automated is just as simple as cruise control, or the safety measures that are in the vehicles, in the new vehicles now, that are help you keep in the lane assist and the cruise control, adaptive cruise control. That's all forms of automation.
And you know, that's happening. Every new car has got more automation. So it's happening progressively.
Absolutely.
And people have got reverse parking assist. They've got dynamic cruise control. They've got lane change. Everything is just happening. So the trouble with autonomous, people think it was like when Sweden changed over from driving on the left to driving on the right. Mm. Like it's all going to happen overnight.
No.
But it's just happening progressively, isn't it? So what's happening here then in terms of like the infrastructure on the freeways and on the highways? What's happening here to facilitate autonomous
vehicles? That's a great question. It really is. Because the biggest challenge that the U.S. has is getting their infrastructure to a state of good repair, period. Just getting the regular vehicles to drive on them in a safe manner, because one of the biggest benefits to connected and automated vehicles and autonomous vehicles fall under that is really the safety aspects. I know I wish that everybody had those lane assists so they don't, you know, veer into my lane. I really wish that everybody had that because there are some drivers out there that are not necessarily paying attention. But the infrastructure is out there. There's a lot being done in terms of how to prepare the infrastructure for these automated driving systems. Autonomous vehicles do fall under that category. So thinking about road striping, lane striping, signage, traffic signals, how the communications network and that's on this digital infrastructure. I mean, this physical infrastructure side, but we also need to think about the digital infrastructure side in terms of preparation. We need to think about organizational, agency's organization. Is it ready to adapt to these new types of vehicles coming in to even make the changes on their infrastructure, physical? Institutional changes, how are they working with other agencies? So I'm working with a federal project right now that's looking at that, setting up a framework for how we move from adapting to automated driving systems right now, our infrastructure, to integrating them by 2035. And 2035 is kind of this international date of thinking when it's going to be integrated. That doesn't mean 100%. It means just more integrated into our systems.
And that's exciting. There is this safety argument. Mm-hmm. We get a front page news story. Somebody in a Tesla on autopilot was killed on a day when a load of other people were killed in automobile accidents in this country. We have the same in UK. We kill in the UK 3 or 4 people a day, 1,500 people a year. It never makes the back page in the newspaper, never mind the front page. We allow people to be killed with manually driven vehicles in the UK because it's the price of our mobility, our commerce, our independence. So autonomous vehicles are going to be way safer than that. Probably not perfect.
Correct.
But I guess one of the things that worries me is, I'm talking UK numbers, if that 1,500, which we currently have kill every year, becomes 300, will society think that it's a disgrace that 300 people are killed by automation? Or will they be delighted that 1,200 people who could have died haven't died? And so is the same debate happening here in the U.S.?
Okay. So what I would say to the debate is that there's no debate that one death is one too many. So I don't know whether when you decrease that amount, if that's good or bad. I think one death is too many. If you can do anything to prevent, if automation, if technology can help that in any way, I think that's a good positive move towards zero deaths.
Well, I'm very excited about it. And don't ask me why it should be exciting, because to some extent, driving is a pleasure that very many people really enjoy. But I'm fascinated by what's happening here at ITS America, because I'm seeing around these stands, and you'll have seen the same as I've had, more digital, more AI, more machine learning. Mm-hmm. This job of everything from controlling the traffic to driving safely, dealing with disruptions on the network, and all this is really exciting. Have you seen some good things here?
everything that you just mentioned is worth talking about. I do want to bring up other aspects of this. It's this whole industry is focused on the technology. And we want to make sure, in my view, want to make sure that it enables other things in society, like equity, not just putting that technology in where everybody has these types of vehicles, but thinking about the areas, the communities, the neighborhoods that maybe don't have access to these types of vehicles, but putting shuttles in that area, having people in the community get excited about these things in a way that is more equitable across areas. So I'm really fascinated in what you don't necessarily see here, technology. The technology enables this, but also the conversations that are happening behind the scenes.
Now, that is exciting, isn't it? Because the whole social arrangements could change as a result of these developments, couldn't they?
Mm-hmm. Yes. Oh, absolutely. Yeah. So before working at Gannett Fleming, I worked for a large metropolitan planning organization and really thought about the transportation network as a whole and how communities and urban areas are really changing based on transportation. In my view, what's happening in transportation. Now, other people might see it a little bit different, but I'm a transportation person, so that's how I see everything revolves around that. Just the changing of transportation and how it can change our landscape, our use of buildings even. And so if you think about a building's use in an urban environment and the movement of people in and out of that building and the energy use in and out of that building, and if you really understand that, how can you now take that into the street network and then think about how you can use your resources best?
So, Laurie, to sum up, transportation is not an end to itself, right?
Correct.
What we're talking about here, it's changing things for the better. Not just about safety, not just about the journey or anything like that, but it's actually using transport as a way of making all of our lives better. And the places where we live and the places where we want to go to and the places where we shop and the places where we live can all get better as a result of what we're seeing here at ITS America.
I buy that.
Thank you. Laurie, thank you so much for joining me today.
You're welcome.
And next on my trip around ITS America, I was really pleased to run into Ted Bailey. He's from the Washington State Department of Transportation. He's the Cooperative Automated Transportation Program Manager. And Ted, we had some really interesting thoughts about how it is great to get back together at an event like ITS America and the opportunities for us all to talk together once again. So, Ted, here we are in Charlotte at ITS America. It's day 4 of the show?
I think so. I mean, it feels like, day 7.
Sure. What's the most exciting thing you've seen, Ted?
Being on this this podcast with you, Leon. Seriously. It's talking with people. I mean, I've been coming to shows for 20 years, and I spend more time in the exhibit hall than I ever do in the session. Not that the sessions aren't great, because relationships are everything. If you don't take the time to learn how people think and what they care about, then what are you at the show? Soaking in the high-level talking points? I mean, those are good, right?
What I'm excited about at the show, because it's been a while since we've been able to get together because of the circumstances of the pandemic, but for me, what's exciting is to see things now using AI, using machine learning, using the optimization of networks, which we weren't even dreaming about even last time we were together. That's what's happening for me.
Oh, absolutely. It's the consolidation in the industry as different companies merge together has been really exciting. You know, one of my roles in the past was putting people on procurement contracts. And so I would come in here and I'd say, well, you're selling this and you're selling that. Why don't the two of you work together? Because I'm definitely not going to buy a separate product from both of you. But if you work together and I could put one thing on the side of the road, that'd be great. And now, after 10 years of those kinds of conversations, to see products start to merge, that's really exciting.
Indeed. And in fact, one of the things that struck me here, we talk about B2C and B2B type relationships. Here we have E to E, exhibitor to exhibitor, to see the exhibitors talking, selling, buying amongst themselves.
Absolutely. It's critical. I mean, you want exhibitor. It's like I think some of the public agency staff should work the floor for a conference and see what it's like to be on the other side of the equation, because it's like an old adage, right? If you If you haven't experienced something until you've walked in their shoes, and you know, the more that we can literally work side by side together, that's where the magic happens. Yeah. And so,
yeah, I agree. And these conversations, like the ones we're having, they spark off other thoughts, other opportunities.
Most of the opportunities that for me happen because people start with a question. I'm trying to sell something to you, and I don't know how to do it. And it looks like you've been in public service for a long time. Can you tell me how to engage your agency, the folks that you work with? The most common question I have. And what's exciting about that is then when folks start to understand the decision-making process within government, they're like, oh, I've been doing it all wrong. I just need to approach you with some basic information, earn some trust, and away we go.
And I tell you the thing that really strikes me at these sort of events, the public sector and the private sector have difficulty in talking to each other. So when I was in Transport for London, our biggest difficulty was that we didn't have the vocabulary to prescribe something that we wanted, and we didn't have the knowledge. So we'd be shining our searchlight vaguely in the right direction. And then on the other side, the private sector was inventing stuff.
Yep.
Which they thought might be of use to us. So they were pointing their searchlight vaguely at us. And somehow we had to try and find a way of getting the two together. And the private sector has a problem for me in London, which was, of course, I come to you with an invention and say, listen, this could really do something great for you. And you say, thank you for that. I'm going to publicly procure that. And you just took my idea and you put it out there in the marketplace, and I may or may not be successful. So how do you overcome that?
So many different ways to overcome that. First and foremost, you don't get anywhere without having transparency back and forth. And so, you know, as the public sector understands that, you know, in order to do business, you have to have a niche. You have to have something that has a unique value than somebody else. And so our approach, my approach, I should say, over the years has been, I let everybody on contract, Leon, because it was like, well, it looks like you probably have a market to somebody in our state. And so who am I to decide through a procurement process that I came up with about 2% of the audience that I can correctly select your product? So how about I just put you on contract, and then if your product performs, people will buy more of it. Let's just do that. That way you don't have to share your pricing. You don't have to share the performance specs. You don't have to share the secret sauce. And you now have a competitive mechanism because you're on contract to go do business. And at the end, that's what people are looking for. They're looking to do business. And if a product is providing value, people buy more of it.
So in fact, what we're saying here, a lot of these products are so flexible that it doesn't matter what your priorities are. It'll deliver those priorities for your community.
Absolutely. And in fact, as I look around the floor at the show, and this is a great show, by the way, most of these products would meet our needs. The barrier isn't the product. The barrier is the cultural transition and desire to choose a product, any of the products. And if you decide that what I've been doing in the past to deliver a service, perhaps I should use an innovative mindset and try something different, then you could make any of these products work because the industry has done a great job. And what's interesting, I think it's even exasperated by the technical professionals, most of which on the public side are civil engineers, that just want more tools, more data. Give me limitless flexibility. And I think the question we need to ask ourselves, and I definitely ask myself and my team, is how much of the tool are we actually using? I mean, people use the smartphone analogy. I mean, we're using 5% of the system's capability, and we're paying for a whole bunch of value that we're not even intended to use. But why is that there? Because we've been asking for it. And I think we ask for it because people ask for what they know. And if you're a civil engineer, you just ask for more information, whether you need it or not. It's just kind of like in your hard wiring, right?
And we have a saying about that in UK, which is, I've got tons of data, but no information. And some of the tools we see here is about getting the information you need out of the data, isn't it?
Absolutely. And it takes intentionality to do that, right? We have plenty of information right now that we don't use. And so you have to decide, well, do you want more information? Does it have to be as accurate? Right? We for years, state DOTs like ours have invested in situ, you know, loops, things that are in the pavement on the side of the road. And then you have, right, third-party companies that come along, INRIX, HERE, others, that procure data in a different way. And our transition to those products is hard. Why? Because we want to understand the black box. I don't think we have to understand the black box. The public doesn't care about the black box when they use Google, right? When I'm traveling up and down the roadways and I come to any new state, who am I using? Google. Now, to Google's credit, they take the information that public agencies push out through APIs and we scoop it up. That's a service we can provide. But over time, you know, when those loops fail in those urban areas, I think we have to really question whether we need to replace those or whether maybe doing business differently with a private partner is a better way to go.
I tell you what I've been looking for, and I still haven't seen it. I still think there's a big market for curbside rationing, you know, for parking, for loading, for unloading, for buses, for cabs, whatever. I'm still looking for an innovative solution whereby I can ration curbside space online. So basically, you know, if I'm driving my truck and I need to do a delivery, I punch it in and it gives me a slot. It gives me a slot at 10:15 on Tuesday. That's that piece of curb is mine then. Anything like that going on in Washington?
I'm going to jump out and say no. But I like the idea of separating curbside rationing for delivery vehicles from personal vehicles. Because I do believe that from a delivery vehicle perspective, they have a very legitimate need. Not that people don't, but they're trying to get goods to market. And if they deliver off hours and you can reserve that space, let them park wherever they want. In fact, they probably will park wherever they want anyway, because it's worth it to pay the fine to park right out in front and take the lane, right? But as far as every individual getting flexibility to park wherever they were, how they want, I mean, part of me is just like, does that really get the mode shift? Or does that basically just make it even easier to go into a downtown core and book your spot because you can pay for it? Doesn't sound very equitable if you can book your spot and pay whatever the market rate is. And so I feel like, you know, from a rationing perspective and an information, parking at the airport and the ability to reserve a spot at the airport, I would focus there more than I would focus in a downtown core.
Well, that's interesting. So there's a challenge for all of our listeners. So when we're together in Los Angeles in 2022, let's hope we might find curbside rationing online available through somebody. So there's a business opportunity. You heard it here first.
Absolutely. That would be wonderful.
So, Ted, what's the greatest challenge that you've got?
Oh, you know, as far as one of my roles, you know, AV testing, right? You know, lots of discussion. We need a national framework. Sure, that's true. Let's assume the national framework's not coming anytime soon. Well, now at a local level, you have the auto industry saying, well, we don't need to have safety drivers in any vehicles. We're good. Okay, well, why is that, Leon? It's because state government isn't sure how to create a pathway to commercial scaled operation. So the only mechanism that the auto industry has to protect scalability is to basically keep it in, we don't need a driver now or ever, because in the future, we know we aren't going to want to have it. If we get it legislated in now with a safety driver, we'll never get it out. And so I think that there's just a great opportunity to just put the elephant in the room on the table and say, okay, you've got to crawl before you can run. Nobody I've ever talked to, Leon, does the first AV test on a public road without a safety driver. So why would you have that be your approach as a state? We have for 4 years. I've been going around the nation talking about how with 15 minutes worth of paperwork and a $5 million umbrella policy, you can test in our street and you can operate the vehicle from your house. Right? You know how much testing we have going on our roads right now? Almost none. It's too hands-off. And so, but the reason we can't be more hands-on is the public, I would say that the private sector doesn't trust that government will create that path that will overregulate. And so therefore, the only defense is to keep us away from any regulation at all. And it's not working, Leon.
Really interesting. Ted, that's fascinating. What a great time we're having here at ITS America. Thank you very much for being on the show. My guest has been Ted Bailey from Washington State DOT. And we're moving on. And having seen my friends from around the United States here at ITS America, I was back with James Harris, the chief executive at One Network, and we talked about the opportunities in the US for One Network itself.
Okay, so that's been ITS America. So what's the big opportunity for One Network in the US?
So the US greatly resembles the UK 10 years ago in one respect, insofar as road agencies are disaggregated, the information that they manage is highly siloed. And in particular, we exist to optimize the planning, coordination, and communication of construction activity in work zones. And in the UK 10 years ago, before One Network came along, we had 175 road agencies really doing their own thing in this regard. And what we've done is built a platform which enables road agencies to manage that information far better, to optimize the planning of roadwork activity, and crucially to communicate to the general public and road users in real time the activities that they are either authorizing or that they are actively involved with. And in the US, we have a very similar situation that we encountered in the UK a decade ago, where this information really is not uniformly managed or curated. And the way road agencies are organized in the US greatly resembles the UK as well. So we went to Denver to take a closer look at Denver and found that there were over 10 different road agencies that manage roadways across that city alone. So that's the sort of scale of the problem. In some states, all roads are managed by the state DOT agency, but across most parts of the US, cities and counties play a role as well. So we've created a universal platform for right-of-way management, for lane closure management, that enables that information to be accurately managed and communicated. And we have some very special relationships that we bring with us. Google take this information and effectively auto-trust it. So where lane closures are updated in real time at the roadside using our app, once the first cone goes out and a road is closed, that can be activated within Google Maps. A very similar thing happens with Apple Maps via TomTom. We're able to communicate the information to Waze and HERE and a number of other players with a single click of a button within an app. So we're very excited to be launching in the US. We think there's a great opportunity for us here, but more importantly, we think we can add a lot of value to the way road agencies operate.
Amazing. Well, look, that's really exciting, James. So, James, it's been an amazing show. Certainly great to meet so many people. So many people have joined us for Lunch with Leon on our podcast today, and also so many people to see and so many things to see across safety, across efficiency, across optimization, and the amazing use of technology, which has been here at ITS America. And I've been the guest of James Harris, who's the chief executive of One Network, the world-leading platform for planning, monitoring, and communicating roadworks and right-of-way changes. So James, thanks very much indeed, and all of our other guests for joining me for our lunch, which has been in America. This has been Lunch with Leon, which is an ITTHub.net production. Please go across to our website and, of course, the One Network website to see what they're doing and to see what we're doing across at ITT Hub. And I look forward to seeing you for our next Lunch with Leon very soon.